I'm Dime Roberts of MediaRights.org, and today on Hearing Voices from NPR, this is Caregiver, Taking Care, Taking Heart. I follow a trail of plastic tubing to my mother's bedside, where she breathes in oxygen pumped into her by a dragon machine in the bathroom. It roars and pulsates with her every breath. I offer her water. Sometimes she takes a sip. I keep track of her medications, many colored bottles that litter the top of her TV stand. Her days are now spent watching TV. Occasionally someone visits or the hospice nurse checks in. And me, I come from far away. I camp out at her kitchen table with my laptop, trying to work when she sleeps, and then run to her bedside when I hear her coughing. I am her child, yet her caretaker, soon to be orphaned. This is Hearing Voices, the best of public radio, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Most of us are going to be caregivers at some time in our lives, whether it's taking care of someone at home, like I did with my mom when she was ill, or visiting loved ones in hospitals or care facilities. At some point, we will have to make a choice to care. Being a caregiver means changing your life, and that isn't easy. We're busy all the time. But when something really bad happens, the act of caregiving usually begins with a phone call, like this one recorded by Joe Frank.
Please don't give me any bad news, Joe.
Well, then I can't talk to you.
Oh, God. Tell me, what's going on?
I don't know if you know, but you probably know that I've had problems with my feet in childhood operations. And my feet started falling apart, rheumatoid arthritis, bone deformity, loss of cartilage between bones, so the bones were up against each other. And I learned about this through MRIs and CAT scans and stuff. And I ended up in a wheelchair because I could not, walk, period. And I still am. But I'm not finished yet. This is so insane. One night, it's around 3 in the morning, I get just terrible pain in my stomach, and I think I'm having another stomach ache. And I waited until the pain just became intolerable. And I woke up, my girlfriend, we drove to the ER at St. John's. And, well, what happened was I experienced total kidney failure.
What? Oh, Joe, don't tell me that.
And they right away had to put me on dialysis because I was completely shut down. And that's what happened.
You're sick, Joe. I can't stand it. There's something wrong with you.
I'm much better than I was. I'm much better now.
Why don't you call me when these things happen?
Because I didn't want to talk to anybody. All I wanted to do was be on drugs. They said your kidney is dead. You,
well, can you get on the list?
No, at my age and with my history of cancer, there is no...
Oh,
it doesn't matter. I don't care, man. I mean...
You can have one of mine.
Oh, come on.
No, you listen to me.
First...
God, you listen to me, Joe. You can have one of my kidneys. You can have one of my kidneys.
Right now, you're over...
I don't give a... You listen to me. You can have one of my kidneys. I will come out to L.A. next week and give you a kidney.
Let's wait.
You'll need to know something, Joe.
Okay.
I can count the people that are as important to me in my life as you are. And if you need a kidney, you can have my kidney. You have your doctor send your blood type and everything out here. I will go get a test tomorrow. I will give you a kidney. I will give you one of my kidneys.
You're upset. You just heard this and...
Upset has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. I am upset. I am definitely upset. There's no question about that. That does not change what I'm saying to you one bit. I'm not going to change what I'm saying because at some point I'm not going to be upset anymore. I'm telling you this because I mean it. I'm telling you this because I absolutely mean it.
Being on a plane. I don't talk to anybody. I have no encounters, but I feel not alone because I'm surrounded by people, well-meaning people for the most part, serviced by flight attendants.
we're all together. And particularly if the crowd has a certain spirit and a youthfulness, I like it even better. To die with this group of people would be a fine thing.
My name is Carolina Acuña Guilartes. I have Mexican heritage, but I also acknowledge the indigenous blood, the Indian blood, the Aztec blood within being Chicana. I was diagnosed in 94. I had an aggressive cancer called medullary cancer, and they said that it was very fast-growing and aggressive, and they wanted me to do chemo and radiation because I was so young. But I opted for ancient medicine instead of Western medicine. So I've been doing and surviving on ancient medicine for 10 years.
My name is Monica Benson Barros. I'm a 42-year-old African-American woman. I have one child who's 18 years old. July 2003, I found out I had breast cancer. At the time, I was 8 weeks pregnant and felt a mass under my breasts. And my breasts are large, so it's really hard to tell when I have my personal checks. But this mass was really large, and it didn't move. Like, a lot of the breast tissue is real grainy. This was different.
My name is Maria Pascu. I am 48 years old, and I came from Romania to United States. I was diagnosed with breast cancer on April 2000, and now I am in remission.
I decided to go the alternative route and use ancient medicine. So I was trying to get away from the fear that comes along with the disease. I feel that Western medicine uses a lot of fear tactics to scare you into doing what they want you to do.
But first, the doctors told me to come back in 6 months because they thought it was just from underwire bras, that maybe it was just tissue. I had them do a biopsy, and it was cancerous. So meanwhile, I've been going through the treatment. I'm not pregnant anymore. I miscarried. And I had a lumpectomy and also 14 lymph nodes under my arm removed. So now I'm having chemo treatments once every 2 weeks.
Something was wrong. I was very tired and sleepy, and on my left breast was some pain. And I go to see the doctor. I do all the tests, including mammogram, and they came positive. So they proposed to me a few choices: to do just a mastectomy of tumor, or the one which I choose them to do both side mastectomy and do chemotherapy for almost 1 year each week.
There's this bias that I think goes on in Western medicine, particularly around the radiology, and they think that people with darker skin can take more radiation. And I sat with a woman who had had breast cancer, and she heard the radiologist say, you can double the dose because of the melanin in her skin. There has consistently been racism as part of science and as part of, particularly as a part of Western medicine, looking at the bias in regards to women too, and then lesbian on top of that. It's like, I wanted to really take back the power. I didn't want to have to answer to a predominantly white male establishment of, what do I need next? Do I need chemo radiation? Do I need this and do I need that? You know, you tell me what I need, doctor. You tell me what I need. And that's not where I was going to find the power for myself. I was going to find it by listening to my ancestors and to the spirits that exist around us, find it in ancient medicine, in the wisdom of Ayurvedic medicine, in the wisdom of acupuncture medicine, the wisdom of herbal medicine. That felt like it was going to empower me to really step in and say, you know what, I'm going to take control of my body.
The financial part is hard because most women try to continue to work during chemo, and these treatments make you ill. But fortunately, I was able to get on disability, which is only $800 a month. But that was my biggest fear, is I went from making, you know, $60,000 a year to a lower income. African Americans, we don't have finances sometimes to get better health care. I don't think we go to doctors as much as wealthier races do.
was kind of cold reaction from my husband, which actually he was so scared and afraid because I'm going to die. And in order for him to avoid connection with me, he was most of the time going to work away from home. And when finally he figured out I'm going to survive, he was happy, but he made me to suffer a little bit.
I think that there are environmental reasons. I grew up around strawberry fields in Southern California, and they did a lot of pesticide spraying. So I feel like that has a huge cause. I think we live in a very polluted environment, polluted by people who are not accountable to the pollution. I also think that rage is also a part of it. Rage in the heart and grief, you know. I know I carry grief in my life, and I think part of that, that grieving process and how it sits here in the heart, you know, it really affects our entire body.
Black women tend to be, they want to be real strong, but this is a time where you have to be weak and let somebody help you. And I've had like family and friends, it's like they back away to protect themselves. I've had people tell me, oh, you need to juice all your vegetables, or you need to do this alternative treatment in Tijuana. And I think a lot of it is people are afraid of their own mortality, and they're afraid that you may die, so they kind of back up. I had a woman tell my daughter that her mother and sister died from cancer, and that radiation treatment doesn't do any good, because I have to have radiation after my chemo treatment. So I think people should just be careful what they say, because every individual is different, and you never know what you're going to go through or how you'll react.
You need to correct your thinking, your mind, and teach yourself to fight and to not allow the cancer to do something.
The women have been socialized to kind of slough off the women's intuition. Oh, it's just women's intuition. That women's intuition is like the basis of our power. And so to really listen to that and to really take time to listen to that, ask people to take your kids for a couple days and take 2 days to yourself, the least, away by yourself, alone, with nothing around you but yourself, so you can hear your intuition, because it's always there.
And you go through different moods. Sometimes you're happy, sometimes you're sad. And it's easy to put up a front that, oh, I'm happy, you know, because you'll have your wig on or your makeup, when really you feel terrible. Just the support should just be for the person that has cancer. Let them feel their feelings without you taking on the feelings for them. You know, if they want to be sad, let them be sad. And the survivors that I've met, they said all of this will pass. But when you're going to doctors every day and you're getting shots and you don't feel well, it's hard to think this will go on forever. A support system, you have to have one.
I remember when I started the first chemotherapy, I believe after 1 week, I start losing the hair. And I say, no, I'm not going to let the cancer to do that to me. I will cut my hair myself. So I cut my hair myself with my husband, crying, but I don't let the cancer to do that. And I buy myself a wig, and I put him a wig on my hair. And I say, not the cancer take away my hair, just myself. So don't let the cancer do to you what he wants. Do yourself to the cancer. Treat him like an illness and take him away from you.
We just heard Caroline Aqua Aguilaritis, Monica Benson Barrows, and Maria Pasco in Three Women, a piece I produced with Mia Kim and Anka Maketti. The music was composed by Maria de los Angeles Estevez. Before that, we heard Joe Frank with Dialysis from his hour Goodbye at joefrank.com. I'm Dime Roberts, and this is Caregiver, Taking Care, Taking Heart from Hearing Voices. And now, Shen Dan with I Only Care About You.
<音楽><音楽><音楽><音楽><音楽> 我将会是在哪里 日子过得怎么样 人生是否要珍惜 也许遇见某一人 过着平凡的日子，不知道会不会也有爱情甜如蜜。任时光匆匆流去，我只在乎你，
在乎你，
心甘情愿感染你的气息。人生几何能够得到知己，失去生命的力量也不可惜。所以我求求你，别让我离开你，除了你我不能感到一丝丝情意。
My story has been intrinsically linked to my mom's story, a World War II Taiwanese woman who never had a childhood because she was sold as a baby to be a servant to other people, her adopted step-parents. The short story is she suffered childhood abuse, met my father, left Taiwan, and had two children, my brother and me. She worked as a mill worker, had her husband die, and then when she retired, got breast cancer. The longer story is that she who needed a parent so badly got me to take care of her the last 3 years of her life as she fought this disease. 3 or 4 days out of the week, I lived in Eugene at my mom's home, 2 hours away from Portland. My brother Kirby lived with her as the live-in caretaker. I was the traveling one, arranging, keeping track, through phone messages when I wasn't there.
Baby, are you home? It's your mother. I want to know how you feeling. Bye.
She didn't like leaving messages. Even sweet messages sounded angry.
Baby, it's your mother. Happy birthday.
In the last 3 years, she got better at the sweetness thing.
Baby!
And then she got sick twice. She went into the hospital. The first time, I flew to Taiwan where she was visiting relatives and I brought her home. We thought she had a lung infection. And then 6 months later, we discovered the reason she was still coughing was because she had breast cancer that spread to her lungs. We tried chemo, and one treatment sent her to the hospital again, this time with pneumonia. My brother, who also hated the phone, had to call me to come to the hospital.
Message marked urgent.
Hello? Baby, it's Kirby. They didn't quite get all the fluid out of her lungs or something. I asked the nurse, and it's still got a 100.8-degree temperature for some reason. It's a little better than yesterday. I hope to hear from you soon. Bye.
It's hard to understand my brother, even when he's not upset. Meanwhile, my mom got worse the second time at the hospital and decided to go home to die. She went on hospice and got a nice nursing aide, Linda, who became our friend.
Hi, Danae, this is Linda, and I'm over at your mom's, and I just want to let you know everything's fine and looking good. She's looking really healthy. Better.
Ma got better and graduated from hospice after 6 months. A miracle.
Had a good breakfast, and what more can I say? Everything's going well. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
The only thing that gave away her health was her cough.
Baby, your mother. How come you didn't call today? Are you home?
We got in a routine of me visiting her every 5 days to spend 3 days at a time with her to relieve my brother who lived with her. Then she started fading again, went on hospice, and just got worse.
Baby, this is your mother. Are you home?
It's weird how you get used to the progression of an illness. She couldn't eat, went down to 80 pounds, lost her voice. I had to bend down to her lips to understand what she was saying. You beat yourself up wondering if there was something you could have done or why didn't you spend more time with her. At the end, we got closer than I ever thought possible. I began to call her Mommy, not Mother, not Ma. She liked that. We watched videos on her bed and tried to talk. At the end, she didn't go easy. But my brother and I were there at her bedside with her friends.
Next message sent Friday, May 3rd.
Hi, Dime. It's Elaine. I just looked at the email from you regarding your mom passing away. I'm glad that you and your brother were there by her bedside. And I'm sending lots of good prayers and thoughts towards you and your family. I love you.
Even after living with impending death for nearly 3 years, it's still a shock when it comes. I remember one of the nice messages when I was sick with a cold and she called me with a mother's worry.
Baby, it's your mother. I wonder if you feel better or you feel good. Let me know. Bye.
I'm okay some days, not okay on others. Death is still the short story. The long story is how we live with it, endure it, remember it, and then let go of the pain so we can live again. We interred Mommy's ashes at the Kuan Yin Temple. I take comfort in the Buddha saying, life is suffering, and the key to happiness is that there is nothing to attain in life. Yeah. Let go of the wants and needs and regrets and learn to be happy. But I'm going to remember. We will always remember.
Baby, it's your mother.
End of message.
My Peace Messages, with music by Aaron Meyer and Tim Ellis. I saved my mom's voicemail messages for 6 years after her death. Every 100 days, I would resave her messages so I could hear her voice over the phone. That was one way I could have her take care of me. I'm Demay Roberts. Caregiver continues with square meals, hospice visits, and bad teeth. That's in a moment when we return with Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
So what are you going to do for me today?
I am going to install your new beautiful gold crown.
Tell everybody you have a gold crown.
I'm Demay Roberts of MediaRights.org with Caregiver, taking care, taking heart from Hearing Voices. Don't you hate this sound? I do. I don't have dental insurance. And through the years, I've spent thousands of dollars on my back molars. Okay, I grind my teeth at night, which is actually a pretty common problem for most people. Not sure what that means, but I do know that going to the dentist equals pain. That's one reason why people might not get regular checkups. The other reason is they can't afford it. I have friends without insurance who can't afford crowns or even fillings. Healthcare is fast becoming a sign of wealth and status in America. Some caregivers think big white shiny teeth should not be the domain of the upper classes. Just because you're poor doesn't mean you have to have bad teeth.
You know how you're in so much pain, you're like, okay, death would be better than this? That's how I felt last night.
When I first got here, it was so bad that I was in tears.
I have a really bad toothache. I don't know if they're going to take it out.
I can't even sleep at night. I mean, I've been having these horrible headaches.
Just relax. Stay here for a while. Okay?
You know, and I was just praying for morning so I can get here.
My name is Joseph McWhirter. I'm the dental director for the dental service at King Drew Medical Center here in Los Angeles, California. On an average day, we would see between 35 to 60 patients for dental emergencies. That is, here is acute pain, here is an infection. All these patients also have difficulties. One of those is the lack of insurance. The other one is the sparsity of dental providers in this particular area that's accessible to these patients.
I think it might be infection because it's running down my lower jaw, down into the side of my neck now.
Oh, my whole jaw is just killing me. You're taking codeine threes, you're taking Tylenols on Tylenols.
One of the things that America experiences today overall is good dental health. They will, for the most part, never see some of the problems that we will see here, where the infection has moved past the tooth into the surrounding soft tissues. These are abscesses within the face, within the neck. We had antibiotics introduced over a half century ago, and since that time, we've not seen very many of those infections. Unfortunately, we see them here. That's one of the horror stories that we live with on a day-to-day basis. They've not had in place access to care for the preventive efforts in terms of preventing dental disease. I mean, we are the institutional last resort for a number of patients, and that's why our waiting room is full this morning.
My name is Ora Gina Thornton. I'm 41. Basically, I had a bad toothache. It's been there for about 2 years. I went to the dentist, you know, I just wanted them to just pull it. But when they told me $200, I didn't have it, you know, and they gave me an appointment to come back, but I never went.
Can I see it?
It's back here.
Oh, it's all the way in the back?
Uh-huh. It's like the second to the last one.
How many teeth have you had pulled?
About three. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had three kids. They say when you have kids, you lose teeth. So I lost three because I had three boys.
My name is Donald Wright, and I'm from the city of Hawthorne. Unfortunately, I'm a hairstylist, and most of us don't have any type of medical, dental, or anything, self-employed. You know, I mean, last night, I actually, you know, my mom, she just stood there and felt so bad for me because I was just racked in pain and I was just moaning all night.
Were you ever just like, I wish I could just reach back and just...
Well, you know what? I actually grabbed some needle-nose pliers and my mother was like, if you do what I think you're going to do, she was like, you're really going to mess yourself up. But that's how bad it was.
You actually had the pliers in your hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I don't deal with pain too well.
If there's a pattern of addressing tooth pain with extractions, they're going to have to eat softer foods, which basically compromises their nutritional value. So here's a vicious cycle. I've lost the teeth. I've lost the abilities to appropriately chew. And here's a secondary effect on my health.
So it's really painful just to eat?
Yes, yes, it's very painful. I just eat like Chinese food. That's about all I can eat now. You know, some noodles and stuff like that and maybe some bread. I lost 10 pounds because of my teeth. My name is Bertha Darnell Masters. And now this one's gone bad and it made this one kind of rotted out a little bit. And that's why I made it weak. So when I bit on something, it broke. I'm very short-tempered, and, you know, I have, like, two kids at home, and I'm like, you know, I'm very short with them because I've been in pain, and I don't even want to be bothered, you know, because I'm in pain, and I'm just irritable, and I really don't smile, and people doesn't really smile back at you when, you know, when your teeth is all messed up, you know, it's just very bad. And I haven't really been back to really work yet because of that. You know, I just feel so self-conscious about it. You know, it's like maybe they won't even hire me because of my teeth, you know, which I know that is a big problem. And it's a problem for me, too.
One of the most heart-wrenching experiences that I had was that of a 9-year-old girl. She had a cavity in a lower molar tooth. And the dentist said, you needed a root canal. And here's the cost of a root canal. Obviously, the mom was not able to afford the cost of the root canal, and the pain went away. Later, the infection came back, and it was a lot more aggressive. And at the time that we'd seen the little girl, she had about a tennis ball swelling on the side of her cheek. And before we could actually get her to surgery to get that under control, that area sloughs. All the skin overlying the abscess just falls off. And here's a great big ulcer that sits on the face of a 9-year-old girl. My first child is a little girl. And I would have to say that was one of the most heart-wrenching experiences that I'd had. And here's something that was easily curable very early in the ball game. A barrier of financial access has a disfigurement in this child's face from this day forward.
I think it's like a mind thing, too. You have to, like, take care of it with whatever, you know, pain pill you can get a hold to at the time. And just not really let it bother you as much, you know. That's how I did it, you know, for this long. Yeah.
So it's like, here I am again at the dentist's office. If I could just get all my teeth pulled out, I'll be a different person, you know, and just forget it. And just walk around with dentures.
Bad Teeth at King Drew Dental Clinic by Ayla Ben-Yehuda. More and more statistics come out about caregiving. Here are some to think about. About 34 million adults provide care for someone over the age of 50. As many as 75% are women. Most caregivers in the United States have jobs in addition to caring for another person. Most caregivers are middle-aged, 35 to 64 years old. That's from the National Center on Caregiving. Now, it's not surprising that most caregivers are family members. And for those without children, more often it's friends taking care of friends to make sure we get a square meal regardless. Here's producer Jennifer Nathan.
I grew up here in this house in 1932. There was eight of us children born here in this room. No running water, no electricity. Really rugged.
Cedric has spent more than 20 years fixing up the house his father built nearly a century ago.
I hate to leave here, you know, but I have to do it. I've come to terms that I have to.
Last month, Cedric's friend John was diagnosed with lung cancer. John has decided to spend his final days in his mobile home, 3.5 hours down the coast in Edgecombe, Maine. Choosing comfort over chemotherapy, John has asked Cedric, a former nurse, to stay by his side.
He is going to move and stay with me until the day I go. The way it's planned, if it works out that way, I'm going to die at home. And the home is his until he wants to leave. It's his till he wants to leave or till he dies.
The two old men met by chance 45 years ago, when John's wife was a customer at a beauty salon that Cedric used to own. They lost touch over the years, reconnecting when John's wife was sick, and a few months after she died, Cedric called him up one night.
I said, what are you having for supper? And he says, a can of SpaghettiOs. And he was eating it out of the can. I said, make damn sure it's your last one, because you'll never get another one. So I went out and I started cooking stuff for him. He wouldn't have been around if I hadn't been here this long.
I don't cook. I did when my wife was sick. But when he come over, I quit. No more cooking. And he's a firm believer in a square meal. Every night was a square meal, regardless.
11 years later, it's time for Cedric to leave his family home to care for John full time. They sit on the couch in John's trailer, surrounded by hundreds of ceramic figurines and half a dozen cuckoo clocks. The two old friends haven't slowed down since they moved in last week.
We're on the road all the time, to the doctors, to the grocery store, to Walmart.
The doctors, it's a routine.
And then I cook. I've got to cook. We eat better than most families, I think, at our age.
Most people their age have families to care for them. But Cedric never married, and John's four children are scattered across the country. Years ago, they never thought they'd end up taking care of each other.
Never dreamed it.
We never dreamed that we'd get old.
You know? At that time, we were never going to get old.
With no one else to turn to, it's up to them to plan for the end of John's life.
I've been to the funeral parlor. I paid for my funeral. I picked out my own casket. And I even wrote my own obituary. And it's all down to the hour. If I die tomorrow, all he's got to do is call the undertaker. He's got everything.
It's going to be rough. I know. I've been there before with people. But he's a friend, and so I wouldn't do any other thing, you know, but to take care of him. He knows all about death and things, you know, and so we're not afraid.
Three weeks later, it's a sweltering late September day. A plastic fan hums, pushing stagnant air around the room. Beads of sweat slalom down the creases in Cedric's skin.
He's just gone downhill. He's having a hard time now breathing, I think, so I'm going to have to give him some more morphine.
John is naked to the waist, wearing little more than a bed sheet. He lies on a metal hospital bed by the living room window.
He had an awful night last night. He started getting awful restless, and he's hallucinating, and I stayed with him all night. But he's calmed down a little bit. Do you want to lie down, or do you want to sit up a while?
I was on it, yes.
You'll lay down, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good right there.
Slide right back down again.
Yeah, that's all to do. Slide down and back. Okay, good. Get it out. Try to get some sleep. God, I'm shaking. I don't know why. I'll cut out this page, this part, and this page, and then I'll glue it together. John R. Gallagher, Jr., 85, of Edgecombe, Maine, died at his residence on Tuesday, October the 2nd.
Cedric sits alone on the long, empty couch. The hospital bed is gone now, replaced by a small lamp with a string of rosary beads hanging from the shade.
Survivors include two sons, John R. Gallagher, the 3rd of Arizona, and his daughters came on Sunday. They didn't get to the funeral. A lot of people didn't know about it, you know. So quiet and quick and quiet. But he didn't suffer. John was a good seamstress also. Not a seamstress, a tailor. He could hem pants, do anything. I can't buy any more pants because I can't afford to have them done. And nobody to cook for, just myself, you know. One night I had crackers and cheese and some grapes. That's all I felt like eating. I don't feel hungry at all. But I know I've got to force myself to eat. I used to cook John beef stews, fish chowder, pork chops and sauerkraut, bake it in the oven and boil dinners. He said he wanted me to stay here in the place until I die. Well, that's what I'm doing.
Jennifer Nathan produced A Square Meal Regardless for the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. I'm Dee Mae Roberts of MediaRights.org with Caregiver, Taking Care, Taking Heart, from Hearing Voices. When my mom was ill, we had hospice nurses and volunteers visit our house every week. The program was free for people with terminal illnesses. For me as a caregiver, it was a chance to take a break, or it freed me from taking my mom to doctor's appointments. Hospice helped both of us. The hospice movement started only 40 years ago in London, with the philosophy that patients should live their last days with dignity and as comfortably as possible. Now millions of people around the world have had hospice care at the end of their lives, either in their homes or at care facilities. Some people are trained nurses and therapists. Others are volunteers. Producers Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister followed one hospice volunteer in southwest Michigan as she visited her first patient.
Here's your company. Her name is Betty. She's coming to talk to you, get to know you, okay? She's a volunteer for hospice.
My name is Betty Alsace, and I kind of made up my mind shortly after my husband died that I would want to be part of the hospice program.
I'm very glad to meet you.
Well, I'm glad to meet you, too.
My husband did not choose hospice, but I noticed that the last 2 months of his life were kind of lonely because people kind of stayed away.
I understand you like The Price is Right.
What is it?
It's on right now.
The woman I've been assigned to is a 97-year-old woman, very, very hard of hearing, so we may be shouting a little bit through this.
Would you mind if I come and see you once in a while?
The price is right, you say.
No, that's okay. Yes, the price is right, isn't it?
I'm excited at my first assignment because it's in a foster care home. For 30 years, I've worked in nursing home, retirement home, assisted living homes. I was a recreation director. You know, I'm a minister's wife, and I've met a lot of people over our life, and we've served a lot of people. And the most intriguing part for both my husband and I is to take off the layers of a person and find out, you know, who and what they are inside, what their hopes and dreams are. And I think it's important for all of us to do that for one another because then we can understand better where they're coming from.
I understand you were born in Buchanan.
I used to live in Buchanan.
At 97 years old, she had a bout with skin cancer, and hospice was called in because she was deteriorating. It was in September that they were called in.
My name's Julie Vineyard, and I'm the owner and operator of Vineyard's Adult Family Care in Galeen, caring for the elderly. Mamie came to me, about 3 years ago, and she more or less has just, it's called losing the will to thrive type thing, where she just, her body is just kind of shutting down. And I suggested to the family that we call hospice in and let them do an evaluation. And so they're maintaining her, helping her to keep comfortable. We allow Mamie to do what she wants when she wants. She eats when she wants to. She has, you know, loving people around her, and that's where she's at this point in her life.
Okay. You know what? It's a lot warmer in here than outside.
I bet it is, too.
Well, they kind of tell you, you know, things to talk about. You can talk about their life, things in general. Like today, we might say something about the snow and hook in on the fact that this is December 1st.
Did you used to walk to the store in the snow?
I used to.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't now, of course.
No, before I left the house, I was sitting and thinking about her. And I was trying to think of all the changes she saw in the world in this 97 years. It's got to be awesome.
My dad worked at Clark's.
I love the part where she was talking about her father worked in the foundry at Clark.
I'll bet that was hot in the summer.
He didn't wear no shirt.
And he didn't wear a shirt.
And he was a hairy man.
And he had so much hair on his chest.
I was glad I was. Didn't take after him that much.
She was glad she didn't take after him.
Is your sister still alive?
Yes. I can't see her like I want to.
Yeah.
That's hard, isn't it?
Yes. Because we need each other more than when we did when we was young.
I'm really concerned about her wanting to see her sister. I know it's not probable that we'll be able to bring her to see her sister, but if we can exchange pictures that they can see each other, that may be well for her.
Henry is gone. He died and left me alone.
Henry was your one love.
He was my husband.
Yes.
I didn't want no other man. Well, anyway.
We like to stay about an hour, if that's at all possible. But you also have to read. We got to keep in mind why we're here and these people are terminal, and we have to respect that and pick up on their needs.
Thank you for stopping and visiting.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
And when she said thank you for coming, I knew it was time for us to leave.
It was okay. Nice meeting you.
It's always nice meeting you, too.
And you take care.
I will. I'll try.
Okay.
That's the best we can do.
That's right.
I thought it was uplifting for me. I got a lot of fulfillment out of going. I can't think of a better way to spend my morning. It's kind of an honor to be brought into somebody's life like that, to be able to stand on the threshold and really look at this person and really just know that they cried, they laughed, they played, they worked. It's who and what they are, and look at them now, and especially with people in nursing homes, 9 out of 10 times they sit there and watch the door, just waiting for someone to come in. And if no one else can be that someone, I'm honored to be the one.
I'll come back and see you next week.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Mamie was produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister. You can hear their series Hospice Chronicles at longhaulpro.org. Caregiving is about taking care of those we know and love and those we don't. Caregiving is about responsibility and compassion, about giving part of your life for another life, be it close at home or far away. Jake Warga has a friend who's a caregiver on the other side of the world.
I'm worried about the kitties outside. They remind me of my cat at home.
This is the person I admire the most, my best friend, Jennifer.
And every night they come over here, and every day actually now, they come over to my room and they cry and cry for food.
I admire her because, well, she's trying to save the world.
Right now, they're out there sniffing around looking for something to eat. If the Ethiopian staff comes by, they shoo them away, but, you know, I'm an incurable American, so all I can think about is feeding them.
I visited her recently in Ethiopia, where she's working. Early on the first morning, I found her picking up garbage bags. Stray cats had torn them apart overnight, looking for food.
You're not about to feed them a banana.
Well, unfortunately, it's fasting season right now in Ethiopia. It's Lent, and so there's no meat to be found anywhere. That one is little one, actually. Little one, do you want some banana?
Banana, little one, banana? No.
No, that's not going to work.
Jen is the research coordinator for the Proctor Foundation, based out of UC San Francisco. They're in Ethiopia, helping to get rid of trachoma, an eye disease that causes blindness if it's not caught early on. She's leading a research team of ophthalmology med students.
So I put the, I gave you,
when we arrive in a village, Jen coordinates everyone to rope off an exam area, readies the swabs, tubes, and such. The entire village gathers around to watch us. Local healthcare workers and nurses start to take role, retesting kids from the last time they're out to see if the disease is decreasing at all. The kids are in a daze, clutching older siblings or mothers, knowing that the Frangis, the foreigners, are here to lay them with their heads sandwiched between the researchers' legs, while their eyelids are flipped back to be swabbed for testing. As you can imagine, they don't like this part. When one starts to cry, they all do. It's kind of like an evil Santa Land's village. Kids have on ratty t-shirts or pants, but never both. Clothes are mere scraps, what we would have thrown away, and actually, they are. When you drop clothes off at Goodwill back home that are deemed unsellable, they get shipped to Africa. A child with a cloud of flies around her face comes up to be swabbed. I try to make out the print on what's left of her t-shirt. BHSC, Beverly Hills Social Club. In one village, an elder emerges from his thatched hut and stands behind the rope, listening to us. His eyes are hazed over with a bluish cranial opacity, completely blind. A reminder to all of us what happens if trachoma isn't caught. About midday, I seek refuge from the flies, screams, and curious children and hide in the Land Rover. Melissa, one of the med students, sneaks in after me.
So this is one of the guilty moments of this job, where you're exhausted and you're hungry and you're in a village, and you decide to hide in the car and have a couple bites of sandwich.
And I know that if the kids saw me, they'd all be out asking for food. I just feel guilty that I have food whenever I want. I have more food than I could ever need, and sometimes I eat when I'm not even hungry. I think some of it is just from me growing up always hearing about the starving children in Ethiopia. And fortunately, the kids that we're taking care of, most of them don't look starving and are reasonably well fed. But there are a bunch of kids here who probably don't get quite enough.
So we don't leave behind a village of tears. Jen usually gets all the kids to start singing and dancing. I admire my friend Jennifer because even after a full day, she keeps working. Late that night, I find her huddled in the corner of her room.
Basically, I'm organizing little tubes that represent one Ethiopian child each. Did I ever think I'd be in a hotel in Ethiopia counting little tubes and arranging them with gloves on so I don't give trachoma to myself? No, not really.
One day, during a visit to the capital to get supplies, Jen had her camera stolen, pickpocketed. Another reason I admire my friend Jennifer is that when bad things happen to her, she's somehow okay with it, puts it into perspective.
I guess I just look at it like people have hard lives sometimes, you know? Why do I know why people steal or why they hurt other people? Why they can't have compassion and end up taking everything as the dictators of their country? I don't know. So there's imbalance in this country. There's imbalance in this world.
I admire Jennifer because she's seen so many places.
Benin, Togo, Ghana.
Not just visited.
Burkina Faso, Mali.
But experienced.
Morocco, Niger.
In her efforts to save the world.
I don't feel like I'm saving the world. I'm just doing what I can to stay connected to the way the world really is.
The person I admire the most is still in Ethiopia. My best friend, Jennifer.
The Person I Admire the Most by Jake Warga. For Hearing Voices, I'm Dee Mae Roberts of MediaRights.org. There are links to all the producers' work you heard here at HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.